Hey folks, before the episode starts, I want to give a quick plug for Locus Magazine, who are currently holding their regular fundraising to keep the doors open and the lights on. I have backed the campaign because I admire what they do and what they represent in the speculative fiction space. I've read quite a few Locus winners on this podcast. Actually, I just checked and I've read a very appropriate 42 of their winners. If you are not familiar with Locus Magazine, it's a respected website, magazine, award, archive, and resource for science fiction, fantasy, and horror. As I hinted, they put on the annual Locus Awards, which is a top-tier award that recognizes excellent new and diverse voices in speculative fiction. They also tell the storyteller's stories through author interviews, book reviews, curated reading lists, international industry news, obituaries, and more. Like I said, I backed the campaign and I invite you to do the same, because I'm glad they exist. We need more Locus magazines in the world. So if you're interested in joining me in supporting them, head over to locusmag.com/IGG26, that link will be in the show notes, and explore the campaign and the fantastic awards that they have for donors. And don't delay because the fundraiser closes on the 14th of April. So thank you, we now join the following program, already in progress. I've always wanted to say that. Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and this is another Foundational Fantasy episode with my buddy James from Take Me to Your Reader. Hi, James.
Hi, Seth.
And if you hear sounds of nature, it's because we're recording on my back patio, because It's high 50s and sort of sunny in Oregon in March, so we're going to record outside. So you may hear leaf blowers, occasional dog barking, birds.
The usual.
Circular saws. All that kind of stuff. So I think people who listen to Take Me to Your Reader know who you are, so we don't have to do any of that kind of introduction stuff, but I'm trying to crowdsource.
I've been on Hugo's before.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
At least twice, I think.
I'm trying to crowdsource what is fantasy. So, You know, this is a very personal, like, what is it to you, right? What does it mean?
Sure. All right. So, not to be glib or master of the obvious, But I think it's right there in the name. Mm-hmm. It's something that is fantastical.
Okay.
Like, extraordinary, a lot of times magical in nature. And kind of awe-inspiring. I think if it doesn't have any of those aspects or characteristics, it's probably not fantasy. It's probably something else. Because I think even something like science fiction, which we're not going to have this conversation with Colin yet.
Yeah.
It's a subgenre of fantasy.
Right.
Because of those things where, you know, it's fantastical, it's awe-inspiring, it's extraordinary. It's something that really doesn't exist, hence the name fiction. But like, it inspires you.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the communicators in TOS Star Trek.
Right.
You know,
Before
we even had cell phones or anybody thought of cell phones.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
It was certainly fantastic at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Where I think it inspires people to come up with these new ideas and
it's funny
and
because
do new things.
My, you know, I already had Colin on for one of these.
Yeah.
but then my last guest on here actually said the same thing you said, that science fiction is a subgenre of fantasy.
Yeah.
But there is stuff that I think gets lumped in with fantasy where it's like sort of historical fiction, but secondary world. So I recently read the entire Westmark trilogy by Lloyd Alexander, the same guy who did the Book of Three and Black Cauldron.
Right.
And there is no magical element whatsoever, but it's essentially kind of retelling the French Revolution.
Right.
And so it reads like a fantasy novel just without that extra bit. So, similar theme, but like, what does the fantasy genre mean to you? Like, has it been important to you at various times or that kind of thing? How did you become a fantasy fan? It's kind of like, how did you become a science fiction fan on Hugo's?
I would say I probably became a fantasy fan before a science fiction fan because, so basically my foundation in fantasy. There's a lot of movies and television from the 80s.
Okay.
Think like Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Conan.
Willow. Yeah.
Neverending Story, Lady Hawk, Beastmaster.
Yeah.
Princess Bride. And a lot of that, it has a magical thing going through, or at least some sort of extraordinary feature to it.
Mm-hmm.
But also, too, a lot of it tends to be like medieval.
Yes.
In nature.
Yeah.
And back to your point with the French Revolution thing, a lot of fantasy doesn't even have a magical aspect of it, but it has some sort of alternate history.
It has a setting to it.
And which itself can seem extraordinary, especially from our point of view where, you know, we weren't alive 500 years ago during the medieval ages.
Yeah.
and a lot of fantasy that I tend to read also kind of doubles as spy fiction or military history, alternate military history.
Okay.
rereading the Rift Wars, which I guess we'll get to, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of military history right
yeah.
in there.
Yeah, yeah.
Just how they fought wars back then, mm-hmm. How they waged war. Probably the most prominent part is the time it took to just do stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Communication and travel.
That's one of the things that I've sometimes found frustrating about fantasy is how long it takes for things to happen. Right. And then a lot of authors think, and I have to make the reader understand how long it took by describing in detail how yeah. we got from A to B. And I will say the thing that we're talking about today actually does a pretty good job of. And then there was another scene, right? So let's talk about that. What are we talking about? As if people don't already know the title of the episode.
Right. So in particular, we're talking about the magician.
Yes.
Or depending on where you're at, the magician apprentice and the magician master.
Yes.
So it turns out this book was actually released as a single novel in 1982 mm-hmm. In the UK and the US. So it's an English novel by yeah. Raymond Feist, first published in 1982. And first... reasons. Mm-hmm. It was split into two books for the US market.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you go to Amazon today to get the book, which is what I got it for, you know, using my e-credits and Prime. Mm-hmm. I got Magician Apprentice and Magician Master as yeah. two separate ebooks.
Right. And you look it up on Goodreads and it's like Rift War 1A and Rift yep, War 1B. Right.
But if you go to amazon.co.uk, it's
yeah.
one book.
Yeah.
So I kind of duped Seth into reading two books for the price of one.
Right. And on one hand, I was like, wait a second, you know, because I had bought Magician Apprentice on Audible mm-hmm. when there was like a 2-for-1 thing. I was like, oh, I've heard of Raymond Feist. You know, I'm right. I do that a lot where I'm like, okay, with the yeah. sale, here's things I might potentially read. And so then when you brought this up, I'm like, wait, it's two books. So I had to get the other one as well. And then I got
if you just read the one book, though, it doesn't really end.
No,
it doesn't. It's just like a... Yeah. Intermission. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And so I will say, you know, definitely try and pick up an omnibus edition or just both books because if you want to see the kind of bookends of this story, mm-hmm. you want to get the whole thing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, I get to count it as two books on my Goodreads. So because they're not short books. And that's one of the interesting things about the publication history mm-hmm. is this was a first novel, right? From Raymond Feist.
And yeah, it was the first novel out of right out of college.
And he had
it was based on some D&D campaigns he played with his buddies in college mm-hmm. and the Kelowon world I think was based on D&D campaign.
Yeah.
Along with Midkemia and mm-hmm. all the characters and things like that.
Yeah, so he kind of had already done the outline of it just by doing that campaign, right? But you know, he's a first-time author and so he doesn't have a lot of pull. And so, you know, he was told by the publisher, you got to cut out a lot of this. And so he did cut out quite a bit, but then for the 10th anniversary, he went back in because it was a huge, it did really well. He went back in and put stuff back in. And so I'm curious if anybody out there has read both versions, you know, the original version from 1982 and the more updated version and, you know, how much was really built out. Cause there was nothing that stuck out to me as, okay, that's extra. Mm-hmm. There were a few times where there was kind of a big info dump, which lots of times maybe I don't love, but I don't know. I didn't mind it in this case. And so I'll say right off the top, I found this super readable and I got the ebook from the library, for my Kindle. And so, you know, whenever my eyes were available, I'd read it on there. And then I just switched to audio when I was mowing the lawn or like when I was like on a long drive, like I drove up to Seattle last week. Mm-hmm. So I burned through a lot of it, a lot of the first one that way. But like I said, it's super readable and that means listenable and readable. I like the way Feist kind of draws the characters.
It kept a good pace, I think, throughout the whole thing. For being 1,000 pages, it did not read like 1,000 pages. I remember reading George R. R. Martin. It's a couple of those later books in the Ice and Fire and Ice series, the Game of Thrones series, they're like 700,000-800,000 pages, and they read like they're 1,000 pages. I'm like, ugh. Yeah.
I thought you said 8,000 pages for a minute there.
No.
700,000-800,000, you know, 1,000, yeah.
Or even Tolkien, like.
Yeah,
this is much more readable than
The Lord of the Rings at times reads, you know, it's one of those books is 350 pages and it mm-hmm. feels more like 500.
Right.
Really enjoyable. But like, what is it about this one? Because when I originally asked you to come on here, you listed a whole bunch of different fantasy stuff that you'd read and then you decided on this one. So
because I've read an awful lot.
Yeah. So what is it about this one that's foundational?
So I think I have to go back to the previous question, though, as what got me into fantasy.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Like I said, the movies, TVs of the 80s and TV shows of the 80s. So like, you know, Saturday morning cartoon stuff.
Thunder the Spider-Man, Barbarian.
X-Men.
Yeah.
You know, all this, that, you know, He-Man, you know, that kind of fantasy stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I didn't know until much later that all of that kind of follows the kind of Dungeons & Dragons genre of stuff.
Yeah.
Even though I actually never played Dungeons & Dragons, I didn't really have that social circle when I was that age. And then by the time I was, by the time I did have like friends and we were getting into that stuff, it was Magic the Gathering.
Oh, okay.
So I played a lot of Magic the Gathering back in the day.
Yeah.
And then also a lot of like video games, you know, Heretic, Doom, Wolfenstein. And that's all also all fantasy based.
Yeah.
And EverQuest when that came out. And so I think because of that kind of D&D style of content and media that I already was either watching, playing, reading, I think that's what probably got me into the Rift Wars, because it's the same very D&D genre, D&D style of fantasy. And I think what I also enjoyed about this book is like the military history aspect of it.
Yeah.
And as you read further into the whole Rift War cycle, it encompasses quite a large spectrum of genre. They, if you get into some of the later series, are more like spy thriller than they are fantasy, even though there's still a fantasy backdrop to it because it's still in the same mid-Kemia world. But it goes more into like the Thieves Guild and court intrigue and things like that.
Ah, so like Jimmy the Hand or...
Yeah.
Or,
Okay. Yeah, once you get into the Krondor series, we get Jimmy the Hand growing up a little bit. And he gets very... Arutha takes advantage of him and uses him quite nicely.
Okay. It sounds a little dirty, but okay.
Like those Dwarvish glory holes.
We'll get to that.
And I think that I read the first one, you know, pre-teenish age. Same with like The Hobbit, same time frame.
So this wasn't like a book that got you through a deployment on a submarine or something?
The whole series did.
The whole series, yeah. Okay.
I didn't really get into the whole series until I was already... floating around in a big black tube in the ocean for months at a time.
Did you pack a bunch of books with you?
Yeah.
Okay. So you like had a footlocker full of them or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Was there little free library on the sub?
Yeah, we had a little library on the submarine too.
Okay. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. And you guys could lend books.
Okay. Lend books, certain magazines, things like that.
I think I know what you mean about magazines. I'll be in my rack. Yeah. Okay.
I did a lot of reading underway. And I mean, things like this were like probably therapy underway, right? Mm-hmm. Fantasy, and it, you know, to me, fantasy gives you kind of an alternative or an outlet. You can just pretend you're not in the real world for a time and disconnect and...
Mm-hmm.
And be somewhere else for a while.
Yeah.
Travel without traveling. You know, go to a whole different world without having to actually go there.
Yep.
You can't.
Like Total Recall.
Yep.
but without as much chance of schizoid embolism.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about what the actual book is about. And you just here we're just talking about magician.
Right. Okay. So magician, So we're in a world where, you know, magic exists. There's not very in Mid-Kemia. So there's two worlds in the book, Mid-Kemia and Kelawan. And Mid-Kemia is the where our main protagonists reside. The antagonists, arguably, from Kelawan, depending on how you look at it. so your magic exists in the world, but there's not a whole lot of magic users. It's still kind of esoteric, and magicians are not celebrated, but not more or less frowned upon, but, you know. And then... On Kelawan, but on the other hand, on Kelawan, they have a large magician class who are celebrated. They're exalted as the great ones, and they live outside the law. And so on Kelawan, the magic they practice involves portals, creating portals to other planets or to other portals for travel, put it that way. And they don't really have a good way for controlling where the portal is going to land. And so they're just experimenting with the portals, and it just so happens that they create a portal that links Kelawan to Mid-Kemia.
Yeah.
And one of the big differences between Kemia and Kelawan is metals. There's not a whole lot of metals on Kelawan. They're very rare and precious. But there's an abundance of metal in Mid-Kemia, and they discover that.
Yeah.
And so they send sorties out to Mid-Kemia to explore what kind of metals they have,
figure out if it's worth fighting over.
Turns out it's worth fighting for, and they wage war against the peoples of Kelawan, a particular civilization called the Serrani. They're already a very warlike people. They grew up generations of warring other peoples on their planet.
Yeah. I kind of felt like they were samurai coded a little bit.
Yeah.
So I was like, is this a little Orientalism creeping in here? Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. They're a very, very honor-bound race, you know, things like that. And so anyway, they rage war against the peoples of the Midkemia, primarily the kingdom that resides in Midkemia.
Right.
Yeah.
The kingdom. So
that's the overarching theme throughout the book is this war going on.
Right. Right.
Between the Serrani people of Kelawan and the kingdom people of Midkemia.
Yeah. And our POV character for most of the book is Pug.
Right.
Right. But it's not just him. It is kind of an ensemble as well.
Right. Our POV characters are going to be mostly Thomas and Pug.
Yes.
And Pug from the magician standpoint, and what makes Pug interesting is that he is an orphan, but he manifests some magic which allows him to do some extraordinary feats that get him recognition from the Duke in the kingdom. Mm-hmm. And he gains title and land this way.
Yeah, he gets made a squire, right? Yeah.
But then through the events of the war, he goes to Kelawan as a slave. He gets captured. Return to Kelawan as a slave and experiences, and now he's our POV for Kelawan as well.
Right, right.
And then becomes
and now his name is Malamur.
Becomes a magician in Kelawan, so now he becomes one of the great ones. He lives outside the law, but he's special or unique in that he's the only great one that's not Serrani or not from Kelawan.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And so we have that point of view going on. And then we have the other point of view still back on the cameo of Thomas as he evolves, not as a great magician, but as a great warrior, kind of magic-based warrior though.
I mean, they start off with them both as boys leading up to the, like, Choosing Day, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm. Choosing Day.
Where all the masters kind of go around and choose their apprentices.
Right.
And there are some people who, like, they know what they're going to be doing. Yeah. And Thomas is a is a strapping lad, you know, he wants to be a warrior.
Right.
And, of course, so does Pug, but, you know, he knows that's not going to happen.
But Pug is, he's smaller.
But he happens to, I like the way the book opens. And this is one thing I want to say, I like the way Feist draws the characters. Mm-hmm. It's not, like, tons of exposition about them, but you do kind of get to know them a little bit. Right. And, you know, Pug at the beginning is working on a task and slacking a little bit at it. And like working for somebody in the kitchens, right? Yeah. Maybe that's why I identify with him. James has got his shirt on here that says, I'm not procrastinating. I'm doing side quests.
Yep.
Yeah. because, you know, he's like collecting shellfish or something to bring back to the kitchens and is like, well, it's kind of nice out here. I'm going to take a little bit of a nap. And he oversleeps you know, kind of gets taken out with the surf a little bit and injured and stumbles into the magician's cottage.
Right.
Right. And so that's kind of the beginning of the magician can tell he has something about him. Right.
Yeah.
And then he gets kind of tasked with looking after the princess who is a little stuck up, you know, and doesn't treat him very well until he saves her from some trolls. And that's what leads to him becoming a squire. And there are antagonists in the book, but like, there's not all that many characters that are just bad. Because like, I always assume, the princess's older, you know, I guess father, Boric, you know, he's going to be a real hard ass. Like, no, he's super honorable. Right. Yeah. And he recognizes what he did and is like, yeah, I'm going to make you a squire, give you some land and, you know, make you into a real boy. Yeah. So that's, and most of the characters are kind of that way, you know, people aren't really like backbiting and
right.
There are a couple good, notable.
There's not super bad. They're all just living their own lives, I guess. And
yeah. And there are a couple notable exceptions, right?
Right.
Like with King Roderick, right?
King Roderick. Yeah. That's insane.
Yeah.
Or Guy. Yeah. Guy Deuce Bautista.
Right. Right. In the audiobook, they say Guy.
Guy. Okay.
Sure. But yeah, there are a couple people who are out for their own self interest. Right. But even on the Serrani side, right, like they're martial and wanting to take over the land, but at their core, they're not evil people, right? And so even among them, there's people who are like, who are questioning, is this what we should be doing? Should we attempt to establish trade?
Right.
And so, you know, you end up with people of goodwill on both sides of it, not in a Charlottesville, Trump, good people on both sides kind of thing, because there weren't, there were not good people. When there's white supremacists on one side, there's no good people on that side.
And I think this is what makes the characters relatable. And what makes the book enjoyable is that you can pretty much kind of relate and understand each perspective and each person, what they're going through. And
yeah.
And the time span of the book is over about nine or 10 years.
Yeah.
And so you see these people grow up, right? So you see Pug grow up, Thomas grew up, Carlene grew up, all the who is essentially this band of adolescents in the beginning as they progress through life in the real court and things like that.
And, you know, not everything goes perfectly well for everybody, right? There's, you know, 'cause Pug gets captured in battle and taken to the other world, right?
Yeah.
And Thomas...
He's a slave for like four years.
Yeah. And Thomas, it seems like something really good happened for him, but there's a downside to it. And I don't know, maybe we should just like go over into spoilers at this point.
Sure.
I mean, we've already talked a bit about it, but like full spoiler mode, you know, Thomas ends up getting separated from his party in the Mines of Moria, essentially, right?
Right.
I can't remember what it was called.
Caldane. Caldane or something like that.
Yeah. And because there's a wraith after them, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's very D&D campaign kind of thing. Totally. Or like the Ultima games, you know, that's what I remember. Like I never played D&D, but I did play some games that inherited from that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Diablo or something.
Yeah. And yeah, he gets separated and, you know, he recognizes that I'm not going to be able to get to them, but maybe I can figure out a way in these caves to find my way back here and keep running away.
And like Gandalf wandering through the Mines of Moria.
Yes.
I can smell the fresh air.
Exactly. Yeah. and ends up finding an ancient dragon. And this is where I think the skill of Feist really shines, is that you know the dragon, I can't remember his name, Ruag.
Was it Ruag?
Oh, Ruag, okay. Yeah, Ruag the dragon. Like, you know him for like 10 pages, and then he dies.
Right.
And I was like, well, that was very moving. You know, the whole thing where there's the gift left over by Macross.
And the Death Watch. Magician. Right?
Yeah.
That was, I think, important.
It reminded me of Project Hail Mary, right? you die, I watch. Or I die, you watch. And he gets a gift from the dwarf who's with him. Dolgan?
Dolgan, yeah.
Gets a gift that's like, you know, Mjolnir or something.
Yeah.
That he gets to wield.
Ancient dwarven hammer.
Yeah.
The, you know, kings of old, right?
Mm-hmm. And Thomas gets this white and gold, or is it black and
white
blue?
And gold.
I don't know. No, I'm thinking of the dress.
Yeah.
I always saw it as white and gold.
Yes.
So that kind of changes him. It's like it changes the wearer, tries to change it back into this ancient race, almost, right? And you find out that. And that's the really sort of kind of science fiction aspect of it, is that it shows from the perspective of Ashen Sugar, who's like a legendary dragon lord from back in the day, but he is Thomas and Thomas is him.
Right.
And in a weird out of time kind of thing, timey-wimey thing, which was pretty cool. But like I said, there's a downside to it because it makes him less Thomas, right? It makes him scarier and, you know, he grows up into this big, you know, 6'6" kind of guy. That's important for the war because he's a very good military commander and the armor protects him.
Right.
It alters some of his relationships a little bit and makes people scared of him. So that was a kind of a cool thing to get to have a character who's not necessarily the main character, but have a really kind of cool arc
as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like how he decides not to go home because he knows he'll just be marginalized going back to Creedy.
Yeah.
Versus staying with the dwarves and then eventually the elves.
Yeah, and he figures out a way to do it without causing serious upset for the elves either, right? Mm-hmm. Where no, I'm not going to be a king here, but I'd be happy to be the prince consort.
Right.
I'm curious if, I mean, you can tell me or tell me that I should just read the other books. You know, I don't know if he continues wearing the armor because he kind of comes back to himself at some point. And I didn't know if that was from taking off the armor or from just realizing, oh, I'm not that dude.
So, no, he does continue wearing the armor.
Okay.
I think throughout all time, basically.
Okay.
But no, he comes back to being himself with the help of Macross.
Right.
Macross. I mean, we end up finding out that Macross was the instigator of this whole thing to begin with.
Yeah.
He's the one that imbued the magic. He subdued the dragon, imbued the magic into the armor.
Yeah.
To expose Thomas to the Valhalla magic.
Mm-hmm.
But then he ends up tempering it so that Thomas does grow and has this struggle back and forth to mature. Right. And then in the end helps him overcome that.
Kind of offers him a lifeline.
So he doesn't become total Valheru, but something in between of both Valheru and human.
Yeah. And, you know, it does remind you a little bit of the Lord of the Rings kind of stuff with the earlier races, you know, and the, that have kind of left their legacy behind, but they're not really there anymore.
Yeah.
And,
like in Lord of the Rings, the elves are a waning civilization. Right. They just have Elvendar. They're not spread across the continents.
Yeah.
But they're powerful in Elvendar with their own elvish magic and.
Yeah.
And they have the Blessed Isles that they eventually go to and their own culture that's very, insular, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just curious if the armor has any effect on his lifespan.
I think it does with the magic.
Okay.
Yeah.
I figured it probably did.
Because he also gains all his features. He starts having, you know.
Right.
He's someone thinking pointed ears kind of thing. And
yeah.
More
yeah.
lean, stark features of the face. And
it kind of reminded me of the in Aragorn series, the Inheritance series, you know, where Aragorn kind of gets morphed into being sort of an elf as well.
So I always envision Thomas in the end as sort of like a half elf.
right.
Half elf thing going on.
Yeah, and if he and the queen have any kids, they'll be half elven, right? So you got to load the next module in order to enable half races. I remember Colin was going to set us up a like classic D&D campaign. And I was like, oh, I want to be a half whatever. And he's like, no, you can't do that in original D&D. Right. I'm like, oh, dang it.
Elf is just an elf.
Like I said, I hinted at, there's lots of times where I think, okay, here we're setting up for a big, here's how we get, you know, on an ocean voyage from here to there. And it'll just, you know, the chapter changes and they're arriving in port.
Yep.
And so despite the fact that it's a long book, it's not long and boring, right? Like he keeps it moving.
He doesn't take you through the day to day.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they're a chapter spent on churning butter or something. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, there's some romance in it, right? You kind of think at some point that it's going to be Pug and,
Carlene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you think even after he's gone away at first point, but by the time he ends up on the other world, you're like, well, that's probably not, she probably thinks he's dead.
Probably not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And
I think pretty much everybody thinks he's dead.
Nobody. Yeah. And I was rooting for her and the other guy, Roland.
Roland.
Yeah. You know, to go off into the sunset, but that didn't happen.
It did seem like it was almost cab for a while and then war takes over.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, on one hand, like, I'm bummed because I was shipping them, you know, but, you know, vagaries of war, not everybody comes through it.
Right? Yeah, I don't remember what happens later on in the cycle with Carlene, like,
because
she lands, I forget.
Because Pug has ended up taking a wife on the other side, right? Who was also another former enslaved person. And I'm glad that I read both. That I didn't just be like, okay, I'm only reading the first one and then we're recording this thing.
It wouldn't make sense.
No, well, I mean, I enjoyed it, right? Yeah. I enjoyed that first book, but it doesn't finish the story.
Right.
Yeah. But it also would have missed out on the most badass scene in the whole thing, the arena scene.
Oh, yeah.
Which was awesome.
The arena scene was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. That was really cool, where like,
hey. Pug just wrecks everything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, screw you guys.
Yeah, he's like, no, this isn't happening anymore, here's why.
This ain't cool.
Yeah. You think you know what a great one is, I'll show you. Because you find out that kind of he had access to all the magic from both worlds.
Yep.
Right.
Right.
The other interesting thing is here, you know, compared to something like Aragorn really wants to tell you about the ancient language and how the magic works and all the nuts and bolts of it.
Oh, right,
this one does not really have any interest in doing that.
Yeah.
Other than it says that, you know, Pug was training with, Colgan. And, Colgan was training him, but he couldn't really make it work. And so he's like, I'm going to be a washout in this, but he still had this instinctive kind of grasp of magic.
Right.
And that reminded me a little bit of the Merlin show that was on the Sci-Fi Channel, where like he had that fundamental magic ability that then just needed to be sort of trained. And Colgan was sort of trying to do that. And it never really worked out until he went to the other world.
Yeah. It's like Colgan didn't really know how to train him the way that his magic worked, right?
Yeah.
It's what we end up learning later on is the greater and less, what they call the greater and lesser paths.
Yeah.
And Colgan's the lesser path magician versus Pug being the greater path magician.
Yeah.
And they kind of have a different power set and different ways of learning and gaining those skills.
Yeah. And yeah, Macross is, the magician is kind of behind everything and orchestrating it all for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. And it goes into some of it, right? I don't remember how much of his sort of overall plan is revealed. Oh, no, he leaves him the information on the island at the end, right?
Yeah.
That was kind of, there was a little exposition.
Yeah, because he ends up having basically a foresight, right? That's one of one of his abilities is this. He has a foresight where he sees his, no, he doesn't see his own, well, I don't know if he sees his own death. I don't remember. But that's not the part he sees in the book, though. But what he sees is the rift creating problems, drawing the enemy, right? Mm-hmm. This ancient enemy that's been, that we learn about through the Pug's instruction on Kellawan. Mm-hmm. When the Kellawan humans first, when the humans first came to Kellawan, I guess, through the portal.
Yeah.
And there's the stranger, which we don't learn who that is yet. And there's the humans coming through the portal. There's the enemy, and then there's the stranger. Mm. And the stranger kind of guides the portal, but then closes the portal before the enemy can do anything bad to the humans that have escaped. Mm. And then, we never really learn who the enemy is in this book.
Okay.
We do learn that Macross is the stranger guiding the things because he's seen this all already. As part of his foresight, mm-hmm. which I think he did foresee. Yeah, he does foresee his kind of death already. And so that's why he kind of orchestrates behind the scenes all these things to happen to enable him to, I think, first educate Pug because he needs his help to close the portal. Mm-hmm. And then get Pug back over to close the portal on Makemia.
Yeah.
Before it attracts the enemy.
Yeah, because at some point, you know, the plan is, look, we just shut down the equipment on this side of the rift.
Right.
And then when they try and open it up again, it won't be in the same place.
Yeah.
It was an interesting thing, like the idea of fighting a war, you know, on two sides of a rift, right? Mm-hmm. Where like, you don't really have any idea what the strength of your enemy is on the other side of it. And you know, their supply lines are... They can build out all the resources right next to the rift, right?
Right.
And so as long as it's relatively conveniently placed,
into the rift,
then that's cool. And it's cool the way it drops the first little mystery about that with the shipwreck, right?
Right.
Where they go out and see the shipwreck, and there's like a dude with a weird sword, and I'm like, oh, is he just from a different part of the world? And that's another thing you get at the end of the book is like, oh wow, this world is bigger than we thought.
There are parts of the world that nobody knows about. Mm-hmm. Or nobody in the kingdom knows about it.
Yeah.
Outside of like rumors and...
So is that the kind of stuff that's explored in later books?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So you get to see more of the D&D map?
Yep, basically.
Nice. There is a big map in the front of the book as well.
Yeah. Yep, and we learn more about Macross and Pug. And, Pug does become long-lived, essentially. And so we get generations of the kingdom after that. Pug's still around, but there's also, the grandchildren of... The Rutha and things like that.
Yeah. There's also some court intrigue in here if you're into that kind of stuff because there's the succession sort of crisis because there's the king who's kind of gone off his nut, right?
Right.
He's lost his cabbage, right? And all he wants to do is, it makes it a little relevant, I just want to rebuild the cities, build a ballroom,
Yep.
You gild everything, and that's more important. And he doesn't really want to hear about this whole war thing. And then the inconvenient Serrani start coming through and attacking. It's like, oh, fine. All right. Go fight the war.
Fine. I guess I'll deal with that.
But he kind of breaks out of that at the end, right? Just in time to name an heir.
Yeah.
But then there's a whole succession crisis there, which, we don't have to give up.
Yeah, kind of manufactured. It never really appears.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because everybody makes the right choice.
Yeah. Right? I feel like we know enough about the characters by the time we get to that point where we know what's going to happen. Like,
Martin doesn't want that job.
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
But I think actually I remember highlighted a part where Liam was talking to Arutha and Arutha was certainly Martin wouldn't want the job. And I think Liam kind of knew he wouldn't want it either.
Yeah,
and he tells him, you'd have to be mad to want this job and be a king.
Yeah. 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 Cause Liam doesn't really want it either.
Yeah.
And, but, and Arutha's like, no, why do you have to be such an honest guy?
Yeah.
why did you have to break to make that public? Right. Because that causes potential problems that they're that he's preparing for, and he's like, I won't let it turn into civil war. So I love that guy, but I will kill him if he does the wrong thing. So and there's lots of little not side characters, but ancillary characters that come in here and there, like Lori the minstrel, who's kind of cool, and he doesn't quite know who Pug is, he doesn't know his potential, right?
Yeah.
There is some stuff in here where I'm like, did nobody advise him on the, I'm not mature enough to read about dwarven glory holes without chuckling a little bit.
Yep.
So every time I read it, I was like, oh.
Yeah, when I came across that book, I'm like, really?
Yeah.
What?
That was a choice.
They really had to do that? That's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, it's an enjoyable book. So like, how many books do you have to read to sort of finish off a story? Because this book kind of has its beginning and end. But yeah. are there trilogies within the saga cycle, or like?
Yeah, I think this one, this trilogy is the Rift War saga.
Okay, and this is the book
Magician,
one.
The Magician, Silverthorn, and something at Celadon. I can't remember.
Okay.
There's one trilogy. Yeah.
Okay. Which does it kind of wrap up the Serrani and.
Yeah, I want to say so. Yeah.
Midkimia.
I don't really remember the third book, actually.
Okay.
That's the problem. I remember more about the what comes next is the Krondor series.
Okay.
Because that's where Jimmy the Hand really shines.
Okay.
Let's see. Arutha is the Prince of Krondor at that time.
Mm hmm.
Or Duke of Krondor,
I guess. Yeah, yeah.
But he basically becomes good friends with Jimmy the Hand, and Jimmy the Hand becomes elevated.
Okay, okay, nice.
Something like that.
Yeah, he's a fun character where yeah. It's like, oh, you need to get out of town? Okay,
so he's
yeah,
a cool sure. character.
I can get you out.
Yeah, so we also see him grow up. So he grows from being the teenager we see in this book, right? To
and you said that's in a subsequent, you know, trilogy or, mm-hmm. or books after the first three. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's the Krondor series.
How many of these have you read?
Oh, like 20.
Okay. Do you just burn through them all
yeah, basically.
Around the same time? Okay. I mean, that's I remember doing that kind of stuff, like with the Star Wars, you know, extended mm-hmm. universe stuff, or expanded universe. I'd just be like, yeah, sure, whatever comes
yeah,
out
the
next.
Yeah, the Thrawn Trilogy is another underway adventure.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That makes sense. Yeah, so when I was in college, that. Yeah. Yep. So, anything else to talk about these books?
I think I covered everything I have, yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I want to say thank you because I really enjoyed these, and I can definitely see how these would be important to people of various ages, right?
Sure.
You encountered them when you were, 18 or 19, you said, or late high school or something?
Actually, preteen, like 12, 13, yeah.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. But then they were...
It was when I read Magician. I don't think I went further
okay.
Until the Navy, yeah.
Okay, okay. So nice, you know, because I don't know, I wouldn't call these young adult really, even though the main characters are young at the beginning.
Yeah,
you know, because like there is lots of peril and mm-hmm. discussions of sexy times and such things. Not super graphic or anything,
no,
but you know, people are getting it on.
Yep.
Very enjoyable. And it introduces, like, it builds out such a massive world, right? And then tells you at the end of the book, and the world's even bigger than that, that I can definitely see how it could be enjoyable.
Yeah, it does introduce a cadre of characters and mm-hmm. a cadre of civilizations to explore, which you get explored in subsequent books.
Okay.
There's also a whole other part of the cycle that goes into Kesh. And you...
Okay.
The intrigue between, you know, Kesh and the kingdom... And then also it goes more into like the dark elves and the dwarves and Lord Mordhel and all that. So yeah, there's different sagas in the overall cycle.
Sweet.
That pretty much explore all the things are that you hint at possibilities just in this book alone.
Okay. Cool, cool, cool.
And relationships and all that stuff. Yeah. That's why there's so many books.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Well, folks, if you want to hear more from James, check out Take Me to Your Reader. It is, you know, it's a fun podcast we've been doing since we recorded the first Forever. Episode in 2013. So it's been a long time. And yeah, you don't have any other places you want people to find you? Right?
Nope.
Okay.
Cool.
Cool.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks, James.
Yep.
This was fun. So thanks for coming over and hanging out in my backyard.
For sure.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Ciao.
Bye now. It's high 50s and sort of sunny in Oregon in March. So you may hear... Voila. Other sounds of nature, including my dogs.
We have
dogs.
Other guests as well.
I should probably pull them back. Boys, come on. Come on, you're getting edited out.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.